Welcome to the Christian Mysticism Podcast, where we explore the fascinating history of Christian mysticism from the early days of the church until today. I'm Alberto de la Cruz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Carlos Ayer, the T. Lawrison Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. Greetings, Carlos.
Hi, Alberto. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, too. And today was the very first, really nice spring day. So it's beautiful.
We've been having some wonderful weather down here in Miami as well.
Yes, 365 days a year.
Well, it does get pretty hot in the summer.
Oh, I know.
I want to thank all our listeners that are tuning in and remind you to please click on the subscribe button, click on the like button, and tell all your friends about it so the Christian Mysticism Podcast can reach more people. So I know you have another fascinating mystic for us today. Who do we have?
Yes, and it's St. Martin de Porres is the English pronunciation, Martin de Porres in Spanish, who lived between 1579 and 1639. And he is one of the most amazing of mystics because he exhibited all the external signs of being a mystic, some of them quite extreme, but he was not learned. As a matter of fact, he received very little education, and he didn't leave texts behind. So all we know about him is the testimonies we have from those who lived with him, who, of course, made sure to document the marvelous things that he did and the marvelous things that he accomplished. But he's a perfect example of the number of mystics who have existed throughout Christian history that we don't know about. In his case, we know about him because circumstances were such that people paid attention to him and what was happening. But there are so many others like him, especially unlearned, perhaps even illiterate mystics. So we'll never know how many Christian mystics there have been. But St. Martin de Porres is a good example of someone who just literally embodied so many of the qualities, not only of other mystics and saints, but of some of the most important ones, such as Catherine of Siena and Francis of Assisi.
So tell us a little bit about him. When was he born? Where was he born?
He was born in present-day Peru, and under very sad circumstances. His mother was a freed African slave, and some think that she might have also had some indigenous ancestry. But it doesn't matter. She had been a slave. She was dark-skinned, and his father was a Spanish nobleman, and they never married. So he was raised basically by a single mother. And not only that, an African mother in a colony of the Spanish Empire where racism was the rule of the day. And of course, his mother had been freed, but there are many other slaves of African ancestry who were still enslaved at the time. And his father didn't actually recognize him as his son for several years. It was kind of late in his childhood when his father finally admitted, yes, this is my son. But he lived in extreme poverty, even though his father was very well off, and he was discriminated against. His mother, we know, was, of course, a servant, but she was also known as a healer. In Spanish, the word is curandera, and she had learned certain skills of African, let's call it holistic or natural kind of medicine, that she probably passed on to her son, Martin. And when he was 12, his mother got him a slot as an apprentice to a barber surgeon. So as we see so far, this doesn't seem like a man who is headed for holiness or mystical ecstasy. Back then, as most of our listeners or many know, barbers also performed surgery on people. But more often than not, what they did is bloodletting. They had those shaving blades that were sharp enough to cut people quickly and as painlessly as possible and help them bleed. That was standard practice back then. But he learned how to cut hair and how to draw blood, how to care for wounds, and how to prepare and administer certain medicines. So from his barber that he had served as an apprentice and from his mother, he learned something about healing in a medical sense. But after a few years of serving as a barber surgeon apprentice and also as a barber surgeon, he was drawn to the Dominican order. So he had on his own, right, without formal education, constant exposure to such things, but simply probably from just from going to church and seeing what was going on in Lima, Peru, where there were many convents and monasteries. He applied to the Dominican order. He wanted to live with them and to be a lay helper. Now, what's going on here? Why just a lay helper? Well, factor in the racism and the discrimination. He also, by this point in his life, another one of these important traits that others of our mystics have had, humility. He didn't feel himself worthy to apply to be a lay brother. But after 9 years of living with the Dominicans, his life of prayer and penance, his charity, his humility, made the Dominican community request that he become a brother. And he did. But what had he been doing for all these years, these 9 years? Well, he worked in the infirmary. Perfect place for him, right? But he was basically a janitor, a cook. He worked in the laundry. He did mundane, servile tasks, but he did them all with great humility and spent many hours in prayer. And his holiness became apparent, especially through his humility and performing these very simple tasks, which is why in the iconography of St. Martin de Porres, he's sometimes or often depicted with a broom in his hand. This man was a janitor, but he also started to perform healing miracles. And his fame as a healer grew in Lima, Peru, which was, you know, the colonial capital of the viceroyalty of Peru. And was, of course, ruled by Spaniards, but there were a lot of indigenous people and a lot of mestizos, that is, children and grandchildren of mixed marriages between, or liaisons between Spanish and native women. And there are so many stories about him, how he spent his nights praying, and he spends his days nursing the sick, caring for the poor, and how he treated everyone, regardless of their color, race, or status, with the same amount of care and being very obviously conscious of their personal dignity. And later on, he would become a really good fundraiser. This is, I think, verges on funny, like humorous, right? Here's this miracle worker. Yes, when he asks for funds, people give. So he ended up founding an orphanage, and he also took care of slaves brought from Africa. He also managed the alms or the charity collected by his priory, and it is said of him that he was the man to go for whenever anyone needed anything, blankets, shirts, candles, candy, and miracles or prayers. Martin was the man to go to. And how's this for extreme? This actually harks back to the very early church. We read about this in some of the earliest Christian texts. His priory fell into debt, and they needed money desperately. He offered to sell himself as a slave and to have the proceeds of the sale go to his priory. So, truly remarkable in that respect. But, there was a rule in the Spanish Empire in America that people of native descent or African descent could not be ordained priests. Now, how's that for a sad situation?
So he never became a priest?
No, he was never ordained. No, he couldn't have been because of his skin color and his ancestry. He remained a tertiary, a member of the third order of the Dominicans. So basically a lay brother. But he wore the habit. He wore the Dominican habit, and he lived in the priory and kept performing all these humble tasks for the rest of his life. It's not like they moved him upstairs to the corner office. He loved doing what he did. He loved working in the kitchen. He loved sweeping. He loved doing all these humble tasks. And yeah, there's a story about him. One story in particular that has always amazed me is that, you know, he would, of course, you know, walk the streets of Lima and find poor people and try to take care of them. And at one point, he brought so many sick and needy people to the priory that they couldn't take anymore. And he had a sister who had a house or a place that was large enough to take some of the overflow from the priory of needy people. But one time he brought someone to the priory who was covered in all sorts of ulcers. He had some kind of skin disease, right? And there's always great fear of that back in this time period. People don't want to catch skin diseases because they usually didn't have cures for such things. But he brought him in and put him in his bed, his own bed, gave him his bed. And the prior did not like that. And the prior criticized him for this, actually, chastised him for doing this. And he said something like this to the prior: "I am sorry. I'm sorry. I'll take him back outside. But I was not aware of the fact that my vow of obedience overrode my vow to be charitable." Oh, and that made the prior, according to the story as it's told, right? Oh, the prior learned his lesson that day from the holy, humble man, Martin.
So what kind of mystic was he?
He had a life full of ecstasies and miracles. What kind of ecstasies? The kinds that we've encountered in some of the previous mystics that we've talked about. For one thing, he was seen levitating and glowing, and he also... there are many reports of bilocations, even to faraway places. And, you know, he'd go into the kind of pose that many of these other mystics we've talked about go in when they're ecstatic. And it's just quite obvious that they're wrapped up in a spiritual dimension, and they don't pay attention to what's happening around them. But he was very active in the world. As, you know, up to now, that's all we've been talking about, how active he was in the world, you know, taking care of the needy and so on. Pretty much like Catherine of Siena did in the latter part of her life, you know. First part of Catherine's life, she was devoted entirely to prayer. But then at one point after her mystical marriage to Christ, she devotes herself to the world, to serving the world. And, of course, Catherine of Siena was Dominican too. So I'm sure Martin knew about Catherine of Siena, even if he couldn't read Raymond of Capua's Life of Catherine. He must have been aware of Catherine. But the reports of his bilocations, especially, are extreme. He's among the more extreme bilocators that I've run across, because short distances and long distances, it didn't matter. Even within his priory or monastery, he sometimes just simply appeared in a room, even though the door was locked. There are many reports of this happening. But there is one report of a bilocation of a man who ran into him on the street in Lima and thanked him profusely for having freed him. He was a captive of pirates in North Africa and, well, basically a hostage who could be redeemed for money. But anyway, he thanked Martin profusely in Lima for having shown up in North Africa, help him escape his captivity. And there's also another similar story about someone in Mexico City, which is pretty far from Lima, who was helped by him. And, well, these stories dovetail or fit with stories of other bilocators from his time period, early 17th century. It's something that is rare. Yes, it's rare, but relatively common to run into in the lives of these holy people from this time period. And then healings right and left. And sometimes people reported that all he had done is give them a glass of water. and they were made fine. He also healed a bishop who was at that time in the priory and got sick in the priory. And the story is one of these charming stories. The bishop, of course, knew that Martin was a healer, so he asked for Martin. And out of obedience, he went without any of his medical stuff. He just went over to the bishop. And the bishop commanded Martin to touch him. And Martin replied, "Why do you want a lay brother to touch you?" You know, hierarchy was very important in this time period. And yeah, a lay brother should not be touching a bishop. So the bishop says, "Didn't your superior order you to do whatever I asked?" "Yes, Your Excellency," answered Martin. And he stretched out his hand, and the bishop then took hold of his hand, placed it on his side where he was experiencing tremendous pain, and then the pain started to go away. So Martin pulled back his hand, but instead of letting him go, the bishop took his hand again more tightly and pressed it more firmly against the side. And of course, the end of the story, the bishop is healed completely. So that story got a lot of attention, but he healed people that we don't know their names. We don't know who they were. And well, once again, I'll say it because it's important to keep this in mind. This man held one of the lowest positions possible in his priory, his monastery. And yet he was known all over Lima. He was known outside of Lima, which tells us a lot about the way in which these stories about holy people circulated in the Spanish Empire. People knew about him in Spain. In this time period, it takes months for news to make it from the South American colonies back to Spain and so on, you know, vice versa. News traveled very slowly, but he became very, very well known. And he died fairly young, but in those days, that was not uncommon. He died just before turning 60, died in 1639. And everyone recognized him as a living saint. And they buried him in the same normal way that all other Dominicans were buried. But when they went to examine his corpse years later, it was incorrupt. That's another one of his miraculous signs, of, you know, these physical phenomena of mysticism that, like St. Teresa of Avila and many other mystics, his body just would not decompose.
You mentioned earlier he was a lot like St. Catherine of Siena, working with the sick. You also said at the beginning that he was a lot like St. Francis of Assisi. In what way?
Oh, yeah. Well, the simplicity, the poverty, the humility, extreme. Much like St. Francis. The self-deprecating humility. You know, he called himself a mulatto dog, which is an insult that early in his life people had hurled at him. Or he also referred to himself as a poor slave. And just like Francis had married Lady Poverty, you know, he had embraced his slavery and his low status in society. But more than that, he was a nature mystic. He apparently had this ability to communicate with animals. And we hear stories about this with St. Francis, too. St. Francis preaching to the birds, St. Francis and the Wolf of Gubbio, where he makes a pact with the wolf. To remind our listeners, or in case they have not heard the podcast on Francis of Assisi, there was a wolf in the town of Gubbio in Italy that was, you know, killing livestock and humans. So Francis comes and talks to the wolf, and makes a pact with him. He says, "Listen, you got to stop this. Stop killing the livestock. Stop killing people. Let's make a pact. These good people will feed you. Now stop killing." And that's what happened with the Wolf of Gubbio. St. Martin's case, it's not a wolf, but various creatures that he seemed to have completely under his control, especially the mice who infested his priory at one point. It's just the place was overrun with mice. So this makes me think that he also knew stories about St. Francis, because he makes a deal or a pact with the mice. He says, "Okay, now you go out there to this corner of our property and stay there, and we'll come and feed you. Stay out of the priory. Never come back in here. And supposedly, you know, that's a story. That's what happened. He commanded the mice to stay outside, and they stayed outside. So in addition to being depicted with a broom in his hand, sometimes you'll see a little mouse at his feet, which is a reference to the fact that he was in touch with nature. And we can also go back to St. Anthony of the Desert, going way back, 3rd century, who, in his little oasis in the desert, commanded the animals, the wild beasts, even lions would listen to him and, you know, stay away. So this theme is that somehow these individuals reach a state of relation with nature that is very much like or identical to the state of nature before Adam and Eve committed their sin in the Garden of Eden, and animals and humans were in perfect harmony. Oh, and by the way, St. Martin, this is very rare for his day and age, was a vegetarian. He would not eat any animals. Monks, of course, there are other orders where, yeah, vegetarianism was pretty much an order, like the Carthusian order. But this was relatively rare to be a complete vegetarian. And, of course, we have accounts of his life from people who witnessed all of these things and reported them, but we don't have the details, the fine details, about what his childhood was like and how he became so devoted to prayer and so devoted to humility and exactly what it was that day by day, as an apprentice barber surgeon, he was drawn towards this life of prayer and then to mystical experiences.
Did he ever write anything?
There's no texts from St. Martin that I am aware of, and I'm pretty sure that there's nothing, but there are, you know, reports of what he said to people, like that exchange between him and his prior over the man with a skin disease, that are examples of his take on humility and on the experiences that he might be having. But we just have the testimonies. And actually, in his case, this also has to be taken into account, that he was not a priest, he was not white, and to be canonized in this time period, his time period, right, is when canonization is actually becoming a very, very rigorous procedure. Yeah, he dies in 1639, which is just after St. Teresa and St. Ignatius Loyola and St. Philip Neri and St. Francis Xavier were canonized in 1622. And they were the first to go through this very rigorous process. And it takes great commitment from a religious order to, you know, put forward one of their own for canonization. And in some cases, it takes a few years, relatively speaking. In some cases, it just drags on and on and on. In his case, he wasn't beatified. That's the second big step, until 1837. And he wasn't declared a saint or canonized until 1962. So the testimonies that we have about him are not of the same kind of detail that we have about someone like, for instance, Teresa of Avila or Joseph of Cupertino, where there are numerous eyewitness reports. When the inquest is being carried out, these people gave great details in their testimonies about the life of this person, the miracles, their ecstasies, and so on. We don't have the same level of rich detail for Martin de Porres. Yet, I think it's instructive that, and remarkable, that despite all of the strikes against him, given the wider culture in which he lived, in which darker-skinned people were considered inferior to white Europeans, it's remarkable that he, through the centuries, that knowledge of him and devotion to him by people who learned of him carried him through all the way to 1962 to be canonized by Pope John the 23rd.
I was going to say, for someone who is dark-skinned, not white, not allowed to be a priest, didn't write anything. I assume he had no hagiographers.
Oh, there were. Yeah, there were. I make this distinction, and I've become more aware of the significance of this distinction since my book, They Flew, has came out. You know, some reviewers have said that I pay too much attention to testimonies that can't be true. But there is a distinction to be made between hagiographers, whose purpose is to write the life of a saint and detail how they were a saint, who may do research asking people for testimonies. There's a difference between that and a beatification or canonization inquest, where people are given a questionnaire and they have to swear that they're telling the truth. And in these cases, in these inquests, these formal inquests, imagine lying is a mortal sin that can land someone in hell forever. And if they're believers, the chance of them lying or making things up becomes a little more improbable, especially if we're talking about testimonies from monks, nuns, priests, and devout lay people. So hagiographies carry, it's kind of a lighter weight in terms of their believability than these testimonies of beatification and canonization inquests, because people are swearing that, yes, they are telling the truth.
I think the point I was trying to make is for someone like him, and I guess I was wrong, he did have a hagiographer who had all these strikes against him, yet people continued talking about him to the point where he was canonized 300 years later. And you have to wonder how much of an impression this man made with his contemporaries.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very clear that he was beloved in Lima. And by the way, he was also very close friends with another mystic who lived in Lima, Rose of Lima, whom we might cover in another episode. These two saints who both were had very, very similar types of mystical experiences, but were not, quote-unquote, learned. They lived in the same city and were friends with each other. And he acquired the same kind of following as Rose of Lima and as any of the other, you know, let's call them European saints that any Spanish culture would have, which is remarkable. I should add, though, you know, that race did play a part in the slowness of his canonization. But there are many, many European saints who also had to wait centuries to be canonized. And sometimes the canonizations happen almost suddenly. Here's an example. Joan of Arc took centuries. St. Thomas More, who resisted King Henry VIII, took centuries. Both of those had some kind of national and political significance to their cases. And one can say that Martin de Porres being canonized in 1962, post-war period, where Europeans are shedding their colonies right and left. The 1960s is a period where European empires basically give up all their colonies. And there's a new kind of awareness of the evils of racism. So it's not surprising that it was 1962, because that change in attitude also made a difference. Well, you know, which leads us to another point, which is, how many saints are there really? We don't know. There are people who live in a little hamlet or village who may be very, very holy and live very saintly lives that nobody ever hears of and never, ever get promoted for canonization. So once again, there's a lot hidden from view when it comes to spiritual people, holy people, saintly people, mystics, that we only see it. Get to see or recognize a relatively small number.
With all the miracles he did, the bilocations, the glowing, the levitations, did that news ever get back to the Pope, to the Vatican? Was there any questioning or?
Oh, there always is. Yeah. And in his case, like all others, one also has to keep in mind that in his time period, 17th century, there are so many reports flowing in. And religious orders are actually the ones that do most of the reporting, right? Send information to Rome to get the process going through the proper channels and so on and so forth. Yeah, there's all of this information flowing in. But this is also the very same time period where the standards for admitting or proving that any of this was true become more stringent. So for every a case that makes it forward, I don't have the statistics, but there's a huge number of cases that never take a step forward. And I'm not sure how the reporting was done to the Pope by the commission that was in charge of canonizations, you know, like how much information does he get? That I don't know, because, you know, it's pretty much like asking of any Pope, how much do they know what's going on in the entire church or the leader of any nation? How many details do they ever not hear? Because they depend on others to pass on this information to them. So there are popes such as John Paul II, who was very, very interested in moving canonization cases forward, especially more contemporary saints, you know, closer to us in time period, closer to his lifetime, who would be exemplary in a very special way. And sometimes he canonized hundreds of people at the same time, martyrs. Groups of martyrs who were all slaughtered around the same time in certain countries where Catholics were under persecution. And he would canonize hundreds at the same time. So I think John Paul II broke some kind of record for recognizing saints and canonizing them in large groups, as well as, you know, individuals.
Taking into consideration his skin color and all the things that he did that caught attention with the public, did he ever have any run-ins with the local authorities?
No, not that I know of. A lot of the literature on him is not, let's call it, scholarly literature. It's more devotional literature. And I haven't read all of it. So there might be some details I don't know. But no, unlike Joseph of Cupertino, Teresa of Avila, who ended up, and Ignatius Loyola, who ended up facing the Inquisition, Martin de Porres, I think the simplicity of his life was such, and the fact that he didn't, how should I put this? It was so obvious he was not trying to attract attention to a specific method of prayer or anything of the sort, such as, you know, St. Ignatius Loyola with his spiritual exercises, or St. Teresa of Avila with silent prayer, and St. Joseph of Cupertino with his extreme levitations. There is a similarity between Joseph of Cupertino and Martin de Porres, is their simplicity and their lack of learning. And I have found this out over the years about the Spanish church, the Spanish Catholic Church in the colonies. They just simply didn't have enough personnel. It's not like Spain, where the ratio of priests and inquisitors to lay people is relatively high. No, in the New World, you don't have the same kind of vigilance that you do in Spain or Italy or some of the other Catholic countries. As a matter of fact, I just very recently read a book about the church in a remote northwestern corner of colonial Mexico, where there were actually men who had never been ordained, who pretended to be priests and served as priests for years, which means that none of the sacraments that they dispensed to the faithful were legitimate. And the Inquisition found out about this, because there was a branch of the Inquisition in Mexico, and it was messy. It took years in some cases to unmask these fraudulent priests. And actually, one chapter in the book has a beautiful title, but I can't repeat the title because it has an expletive or bad word about what one of these fake priests said about the Inquisition. He said, you know, blank the Inquisition. I don't give a damn. So Lima was not like this area in northwest Mexico. It was a city and things were a little more controlled. But no, they just didn't have enough personnel. to have the same kind of vigilance. So that might be one of the reasons that Martin was accepted for what he was without much fuss.
So tell us, what's your favorite story about St. Martin's mysticism?
I think it would have to be, as with St. Francis, my favorite St. Francis story is the Wolf of Gubbio story, which many scholars say, you know, oh, that can't be true. That didn't happen. It doesn't appear until, you know, 100 years after his death. But I say it's quite probable that there was an oral tradition of the story that was passed on among Franciscans and didn't get written down for a century. But I am just so captivated by the idea of this kind of humility and moral simplicity that allows Martin and Francis to deal with nature humanely, which, you know, raises all sorts of questions because, you know, what's the natural order? The natural order, of course, is that animals don't follow human rules. But in a way, what Martin is doing with the mice is he's humanizing. He's making them obedient. Plus, he is also, at the very same time, practicing a sort of charity, right? He's feeding them. In the way that in our culture, people feed birds. They feed other creatures to wild creatures. And some people spend an inordinate amount of money feeding birds, and even more inordinate amount of money keeping pets at home. What do we do with pets? We humanize them. But in the case of Martin with the mice, and St. Francis with the wolf, and St. Anthony of the Desert with lions, they have fixed the problem that St. Paul talks about in one of his epistles. That, you know, all nature, all of nature, is waiting for the final salvation, final redemption. And the promise made in the Old Testament, the lion shall lie down with the lamb, right? That predation, the consumption of flesh and blood beings, human and animal, will stop. That there will be a kinder, much kinder way of life in the world to come. So that's why I like that story. I also like all the accounts we have of him being humble, despite the obvious attention that someone like him was getting in Lima for his ability to heal people. And I have another story. I mean, this has nothing to do with Martin de Porres himself, but it's a personal story. It involves my brother, because, as I think I've said before, he and I came to the U.S. without our parents. And we were shuttled back and forth several foster homes. The one foster home we ended up in Miami, which was very nasty because half the kids had already been in trouble with the law. A couple of them had already served juvenile prison sentences, and they were gang members, and it was terrible. And this was just about three or four blocks from the old Orange Bowl, which even back then was a bad neighborhood. And my brother was walking around, and he sees this holy card laying on the sidewalk or the grass. I can't remember which. And he picks it up. And it was a holy card for St. Martin de Porres. And it had a very beautiful prayer on the back, which I can't remember. But it really helped my brother a lot. Helped me too, but at that time I was 3 years younger, so I wasn't as traumatized by the home for juvenile delinquents as he was. So it helped him more than it helped me. And he kept it for years and years and years. And he stopped being religious. He dropped the church. He got to a point where he didn't care anymore about St. Martin de Porres. But for a while there, across the centuries, right, St. Martin helped someone who was in a situation similar to his. Always had a soft spot for Martin de Porres.
Well, that's my favorite story, the one you just told. That's amazing.
Yeah, because the holy card must have been very recent. We're talking about early 1963. So he was a brand new saint. And it's also that time period is the Second Vatican Council. And a lot of, I've noticed, I just looked it up online today, there are a lot of Catholic churches in the United States named after St. Martin de Porres. And we have one here in New Haven. So he continues to impress people.
Well, I would say it's nothing short of miraculous that someone so humble, who suffered discrimination, who never made it to the priesthood, made such an impression not only on his contemporaries, but centuries into the future, to the point of, I would consider it a miracle, being there on that, on the floor in front of your brother when he needed it most.
Yeah. You know, I think that's probably my first encounter with something that I thought could be a miracle. It was strange. Definitely was.
Well, over the years, I've become less and less trusting of coincidences.
Yeah, the age does that to you, because you realize, I think, some coincidences are just too much to be coincidences.
That's certainly true. St. Martin de Porres led an incredible life, and probably besides his mysticism and levitations and bilocations and glowing and the miracles he performed and the healings, I think it's safe to say that his humility and his simplicity is really what has carried his legacy throughout all these years.
Yes. And sometimes it doesn't matter how many centuries it takes for someone to be recognized as a saint. But there's no doubt about it. From day one, the things that, you know, people were witnessing were considered supernatural. There are many, many other people like him in history. We just don't know how many.
Well, we're certainly not going to be able to get to them on the show.
No. Not unless some other quote-unquote coincidence happens. And, you know, we run into information not previously available.
Well, even though we won't be able to get to all of them, we're going to get to the next one. And who's the next one?
Well, you know, I've been thinking for a while that there's one person who is responsible for turning the study of mysticism into a very serious academic subject, as well as a very serious and popular devotional subject. And this is a woman who was a member of the Anglican Church, Evelyn Underhill, who started to write about mysticism and started to awaken the public in the early 20th century to all of these marvelous texts and all these marvelous people who had, of course, in the Church of England, been forgotten or swept under the carpet because they were Catholics and, well, that's a problem, or was considered. But no, she did quite a bit and wrote quite a bit, too. And she's a fascinating person. And many revere her as a saint. So I think this will bring us, I know we keep going back and forth in time, but I think it's time for us to deal with the question of, you know, how does this subject become significant or gain attention in an increasingly secular, materialistic culture?
Well, our listeners will have to tune in on the next episode to find the answer to that. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in, and until the next time, thank you for listening to the Christian Mysticism Podcast. If you have any questions for Dr. Ayer, you'll find our email address in the show notes. Just send it over and we'll try to answer it in a future episode. And don't forget to click the subscribe button so you don't miss the next episode of the Christian Mysticism Podcast.